All right, good afternoon, and to those of you who are here this morning, welcome back. I'm Maria Polante from the U.S. Copyright Office. My colleagues up here at the table are Michael Shapiro from the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office and the head of the U.S. delegation. To his left is Neil Graham from the Patent and Trademark Office as well. To my right, Michelle Woods and Stephen Tepp, both Senior Counsel for Policy and International Affairs here at the Copyright Office. And like this morning, Paula Pena will be timing your statements as we open. Please keep them to 5 minutes. And if you exceed 5 minutes, you'll hear the bell. And that's your cue to wrap up. We have a lot of time this afternoon, so there's always the possibility that we'll finish early. We're optimists up here. However, take all the time you need, and we have until 5:15 if necessary. So the topic, of course, is possible actions to facilitate and enhance access to copyrighted works for the blind or other persons with disabilities. We really hope that you will hit on a number of different topics, including developing standardized accessibility formats, and expand on some of the things we learned this morning, establishing trusted intermediaries going forward to coordinate resources, eliminate unnecessary duplication of accessible works and ensure best practices, providing technical assistance, coordination, and educational outreach, promoting market-based solutions achieved through private sector copyright licensing or other agreements, and developing binding or non-binding international instruments, including a treaty that would establish minimum requirements for limitations and exceptions for the blind, visually impaired, and other reading disabled persons. I'll introduce the participants, starting to my left. We have Jamie Love from Knowledge Ecology International. We then have Carrie Russell from the American Library Association, Association of Colleges and Research Libraries, and Association of Research Libraries. A lot of libraries, Carrie. Ellen Adler from the Association of American Publishers, Scott LaBarre representing the National Federation of the Blind, Keith Cooperschmidt from Software and Information Industry Association, George Kirscher from the DAISY Consortium, Rashmi Rangnath from Public Knowledge, Gary Mudd from the American Printing House for the Blind, Danny O'Brien here from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Fritz Attaway from the Motion Picture Association of America, and Peter Chapman from Pearson. Jamie, we will start with you if you'd like to give a 5-minute opening statement.
Thank you. Is this turned on, or do I have to do anything? It's automatic?
It's automatic.
Thank you. Knowledge Ecology International is an NGO. We have an office in Geneva. We have an office in Washington, D.C. And we think there are several things to be done to make things better. But one thing I'd like to talk first about is the proposal by the World Blind Union to have a treaty for improved access for blind, visually impaired, and other reading disabled persons. And the proposal by the World Blind Union was something that we had an opportunity to work with the World Blind Union. Some of the people are in the panel here, like George Kirschner and for the people in the DAISY Consortium and Bookshare, American Library Association. A lot of people were in other countries were involved in this exercise to sort of look at the what might be done at the international level to make it easier to facilitate the importing and exporting of works which are done in accessible formats. Now, I think in our written comments, we submitted some information or some submissions that both went to the issue of standards, but also went to the issue of language issues and sort of the distribution of language. I think for over 20 years, the IFLA with libraries and the World Blind Union has been asking the international community to make it easier to share works which are created in one country with people who have reading disabilities in a different country. Now, this morning, I believe you had a pretty impressive tutorial on how expensive and difficult it is to create works that are accessible and how many different types of needs there are. I mean, some people need Braille. Some people may need a variety of different things. And
Jamie, I think that might be your BlackBerry interfering with your microphone.
Oh, is that right? I'm sorry.
Get away.
good call. I'm not really a longtime BlackBerry person, so I wouldn't have thought about that. There's never enough. There's never enough copies that are made available. There's never enough money made available to do things. There's never enough economic incentive for things on the one hand. So the idea of creating a system where if works are created in the United States that are accessible, they could be shared with somebody who, if it was an English document, in some of the 60 countries that where English is an official language, or if it was one of the countries like the half of Europe, which the 34% of Europe which speaks English as a second language, that there could be more sharing of documents, and that Americans such as my mother-in-law, who went blind at the end of her life, and was a native French speaker, could get access to works that were she was used to reading things in French, and that was just completely closed off to her at the end of her life, and I think that was unfortunate. So I think that having a global system that has import and export is really kind of an important idea. Another feature of this proposal I thought was really important was in the U.S. you have an authorized identity, the Chaffee Amendment, and some of the educational things, which are focused very much on nonprofit institutions, the authorized entity approach. And in the World Blind Union proposal, I think that's embraced as the idea of something that every government really needs is a core and a backbone of a system of exceptions. But they also had the idea that there could be a somewhat less broad exception that would apply to commercial entities to create opportunities for businesses to provide products and services that would meet certain needs in cases where a publisher wouldn't really have done what was wouldn't made an accessible work available in those limited cases. So, for example, we have this case where the Kindle, and I've got a copy of the Kindle here, and I have a book on here that has reading disabled on it, so I couldn't from a Toni Morrison, where you can't turn on the text to speech. The idea would, if a person doesn't really make available something that is accessible, and if there's not an accessible copy in some way, if there's no barrier, that the exception would come into effect in those cases. I really think that the case of the Kindle, I think I'm probably short on time, so I'm going to wind up right here, is a shocking and appalling case that you've got a technology which is mainstream, that this has 250,000 plus titles available, and the policy by Random House and by the Authors Guild is to de-engineer the accessibility, to take what is a standard accessibility thing, which is text to speech, and make it so it doesn't work. Like this book on it I have from Toni Morrison and all of Obama's books. It does allow you to change the font size. There's a key for it. You can make big. You can blow up the print. That hasn't been disabled yet. But this other thing, and I think like
Jamie,
let's, contracts,
Jamie.
This is the final thing I'd say is just that I think that a contract that says that you cannot make a text-to-speech should not be an enforceable contract in the United States. Thank you.
Okay. And everyone, please keep in mind, you'll have plenty of time later on to get back into the points that you don't get to make in your opening statement. Carrie.
I'd like to reserve my comments. What I want to talk about just right now is the international treaty, because that's where I think we have the most input. As Jamie said, American Library Association was involved with the meetings that were held with World Blind Union about developing an international treaty, and I think that they're absolutely to be commended for all the work that they've done. When I was in those meetings, I learned a lot of stuff about just the incredible inequities across the world. And I'm a librarian, and for me, you know, reading is so central to having a successful life. And I think that everybody should really be able to read. So anything that we can do to enable that, I think is very, very critical. So we do support an international treaty. But I have to also mention that in terms of the people that I talked with, librarians are afraid or concerned that anything that would happen internationally might impact what they have already now in terms of Chaffee. And we know that international treaties are supposed to be, you know, this is just the minimum, but so often minimums become maximums. minimums become poured through a three-step test, and all of a sudden things are not as strong as they were before. So that would be our primary concern. But we do endorse the treaty, and I can talk more about that as we go through the question and answer.
Thank you very much. Ellen? Okay. Thank you. Scott LaBar.
I fear precedent has been is being set here, but I'm going to reverse it. I guess in this topic area, we feel that there would be a lot of benefits from a international treaty or some form of codification. Certainly, if it's a sound treaty, like the proposal that's been worked up, it would help make the argument in this country even stronger for a pro-access point of view. Of course, secondly, there is great benefit to sharing books across borders. Blind people in this world live largely in poverty. It's a lack of education, lack of literacy, lack of power that we discussed, or I discussed this morning. And the more we can promote literacy throughout the world through access to books, I think it only raises the class into a higher status. And finally, maybe an international treaty, if it addressed the DRM issues and the anti-circumvention issues, would be very helpful to get around some of those issues and establish some norms. So I think there's a great benefit in this, and I hope the process continues to move forward.
Thank you. Keith.
Well, thank you for having me here today. As our name implies, the organization I represent, the Software and Information Industry Association, we represent software companies and digital content companies. I heard somebody this morning talk about their members struggling to sort of cross that digital divide. Well, that's something all of our members have done. They wouldn't be members of SIA if they hadn't already done that. They make, you know, digital products, digital content, software, which of course is digital. They, as well as SIA itself, have long recognized the challenges faced by the blind and visually impaired in accessing copyrighted software and digital content, and have long worked with these organizations that represent the interests of the blind and visually impaired community toward the goal of improving access to these works through efforts like with entities like the Section 508 Accessibility Board and the European Commission. SIA and our members have worked constructively and on a collaborative basis to provide usable tools and services that enable all citizens to participate fully in the information-based society. We have also, as well as our members, worked directly with the blind and visually impaired to ensure that the entire community can use these software products and digital content products and services in formats that do meet their needs through things like developing best practices and technical assistance and educational outreach, as well as promoting various market-based solutions that we've gone into, I think, in some of our comments, and significantly modifying the functionality and form of especially software products to make them more accessible. Of course, there's no doubt, I mean, it was just talked about this morning, that some types of works and some types of formats are further along in reaching these goals than others. That should come as no surprise. For the companies that I represent and the type of works, there are certainly greater advancements in accessibility for those products that are offered over the web rather than those that come in CD-ROM, largely because of screen reader technology. We understand that that's certainly not seamless, and there's some issues surrounding that, but it certainly has come a long way. And the one thing I want to add to my hopefully brief comments is that in reviewing the comments, I was a little surprised, really, by at least what I perceived as a lot of agreement amongst the comments. And I think that, unless I'm getting something wrong here, if you look at the number of reply comments that were filed, there weren't a whole heck of a lot, which is pretty unusual for a Copyright Office proceeding. to me, I mean, we can't overlook that. It seemed like there was a lot of agreement. I'll exclude certain issues like DRM and the Chafee Amendment from that because there certainly were disagreements there. But in terms of, you know, the goals that we all have in mind, the best way to achieve these goals, which seem to be an overwhelming support of sort of market-based solutions, marketplace solutions, and the numerous issues or several issues that stand in the way of achieving those goals, quite frankly, only one of which is copyright. It seemed like I'm a little out of my element here because it seems like more of the issues that stand in our way are not really copyright-based at all. It became clear that there were a lot of areas that were there were, at least in broad context, agreement. And it also became clear that these are pretty complicated issues. I mean, in surveying our members, there was really no one expert. We might have, you know, someone who they're very complicated issues related to technology, copyright, to interoperability and compatibility, to things like capacity building and accessibility. And they seem to be very, very complex issues, and it seemed like certainly those are issues that we need to focus here in the United States in getting our house in order, certainly before we brought our problems outside the United States, where, from what I understand, certainly things are a lot more difficult and a lot more complex. So if you were to come to me and say, gee, what's the best way to solve these problems, I don't think an international treaty would have been at the top of my list. That's it.
Thank you, Dr. Krischer.
The DAISY Consortium is made up of libraries and organizations from around the world. The major libraries are full members. They also make up representatives of the IFLA. It was called a Section for the Blind, and they just changed their name. I think it's for the handicapped at this point, so it merged a couple sections. But I believe that this group can make up a backbone of trusted intermediaries that could work with an international copyright exception that would have immediate huge gains to organizations through and people throughout the world. So it was the IFLA, World Blind Union, and DAISY that have been talking with WIPO for a number of years now, and how the treaty got promoted to where we have it right now. The way I envision this working is we first of all need to have a way to move an exception that allows us to move content across a national border. The kids up in Canada are crying for the books that we have here in the United States, and we cannot give it to them. And it's very hard to say, I'm sorry, we don't have a copyright law that allows us to give this to the CNIB, Canadian National Institute for the Blind, and have them provide it to you. But the way I envision this working is that a good citizen like Recording for the Blind and Dyslexic or Bookshare would work with a good citizen in Canada, CNIB, that distributes content legally under their copyright exception. What we need to be able to do is move the book from RFB&D to CNIB. We both use the same format. The DAISY format is being used throughout the world. So that's good. The players, it's the same players that are used throughout the world. And we, RFB&D, would be able to move it to Canada, to any country that we had a trusted relationship with. So there's a series of trusts that's going on here. We would want to make sure that when we provided a copy to CNIB for legal distribution in their country, that it would go no farther. We do expect that we'd recover some fees to help us cover our costs of production. We would like to have a similar relationship with RNIB and other libraries. Similarly, we'd love to get titles that CNIB produced and RNIB produced, all within a network, a trusted network, where everybody's gaining. So in the developing world, there's very few titles. We've had a developing countries program in DAISY. We've established focal points in a whole variety of different countries in Thailand, India, Bangladesh, many, many other countries. The minimum requirement that they're saying to start a library in a country is 1,000 titles. And many of these organizations have sufficient funding to produce 80 to 100 or 200 titles a year. So it's going to take them at least 5 years before they've got a collection that's worthy of starting to distribute legally within their country. The copyright exception would allow many of the industrialized countries to help these organizations out, build a collection that would have huge immediate benefits. We want to work cooperatively with the publishers, help them produce accessible content that we could buy and they could sell in any country. But we have to have this exception to provide us with the ability to start sharing content between fine organizations throughout the world. Thank you.
Thank you. Rashmi.
Maria, thank you for having me on this panel. I want to talk about two issues today. The first one is market-based solutions to increase access, and the second one is of an international treaty establishing minimum requirements for facilitating access to the blind. The first issue, we believe that market-based solutions are important and that they should be encouraged. Oftentimes, they permit entities to overcome some of the limits of the Section 121 exception. Who qualifies as an authorized entity, who qualifies as a blind person, and what qualifies as an accessible copy. However, the market is not the answer to all the problems. As a study published by WIPO and referenced in the Federal Register notice mentioned, creating accessible copies is expensive, and publishers will not undertake the responsibility to create these copies if they feel like the investment does not justify a return. As the WIPO study noted, this may be the reason for paucity in the number of accessible copies that are available. Hence, the need for continued exceptions to copyright law to enable accessibility to a wide number of works. In addition, past behavior has shown that commercial entities are not always sensitive to the needs of the blind. They have actively thwarted technologies that would allow access. The Kindle is an example. Everybody has referred to the Kindle. DRM is used in a way that does not allow adaptive technologies to work with publications. Even the Copyright Office has, these claims of harms to right are based on dubious claims to rights, which even the Copyright Office in its 2003 rulemaking noted may not be available to the copyright owner. The second issue is that of an international treaty establishing minimum requirements for limitations and exceptions. We believe that such a treaty is important for two reasons. First, it would harmonize import and export laws of countries and facilitate easier movement of accessible copies. Some of the reasons for the inability to import and export may be that accessible copies are made by specialized entities under limitations and exceptions to copyright law. Therefore, rights in the copies may not be exhausted, and moving them across national borders may be considered an infringement of copyright. Further, laws in different countries are not uniform, and importing a copy into one country may be beyond the scope of exception under which it was made in the exporting country. Second, an international treaty would offer guidance to countries to craft limitations and exceptions to copyright law. The current international copyright regime provides extensive rights to copyright owners, and it is difficult for many countries to devise limitations, and studies published by the WIPO have noted this. As one study published by Judith Sullivan points out, international conventions do not seem to have been drawn up with the legislator delivering exceptions to copyright in mind. Therefore, an international treaty is essential. Further, an international treaty would reconcile the copyright regime with other international instruments, for example, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which requires access to knowledge to be considered a fundamental human right, which states are obliged to secure for their citizens. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Mudd.
Thank you again, Maria, for inviting us on the panel. The American Printing House for the Blind, we are participating members of the DAISY Consortium, We operate the NIMAC, the National Instructional Materials Access Center. However, we are somewhat restricted with the funding that comes from U.S. Congress through the Department of Education to serve the population of American citizens, American visually impaired students. That being said, there's a part of us that wants to be a good world citizen and believe in literacy for all people because it does raise all of us up. However, the practical side, being a good citizen of the United States, sort of makes us think that maybe we should try to get it right in the United States before we try to export it. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. O'Brien.
Thank you as well for giving us the opportunity to speak on this panel on this important topic. I'd like to sort of sidestep the discussion of the international agreement and concentrate on one of the other areas of discussion in this panel, which is about technical norms, open standards, and other ways that we can further enhance access. In particular, I'd like to, as a group concerned with both individual rights and the possibilities of new technology, to bring into scope some of the other ways that innovation can be driven in this area, and the ways in which digital technology enhances not only access, but the tools that provide access. There's a wider area of involvement here that we see in other domains, that sort of highly distributed collective efforts that have led to Wikipedia, Linux, and other tools. We see some of that power in the community-driven success of Bookshare. But I think also we see this as a future promise in making reading accessible. And if I would like to emphasize the key point here, which we believe that individuals in the disabled community, as those best placed to determine their own accessibility needs, should be empowered to personalize the presentation of copyrighted works that they access, as well as be given the opportunity, as everyone else is in the digital world, to innovate new presentation forms, which they can share with other members of their community, and given the context in which we discuss this, the world. We feel empowering disabled users in this way is not only the most effective route to meaningful access to works for the widest range of reading disabled, but also has beneficial effects for everybody in the digital creative ecosystem. Look, to illustrate this, let me give an example from the rich history of individuals with disabilities' involvement in the history of modern technology. I know that there's one particular format that almost all of us use, mainly because I read How to Get Here using it, which is Adobe's Portable Document Format, or PDF. One of the technologies used to convert the previously accessibility unfriendly PDF into a form readable by screen readers and other assistive devices was PDF2HTML, which is developed by a computer scientist who I believe now works at Google, called TV Raman, who he is himself blind. Transforming PDF to the web's native open and interoperable format HTML makes PDFs easier to read by Raman and his fellow blind users, but it also makes PDF documents easier to access by all internet users. That code that Raman wrote is the code that allows Google, which I heard described by one technologist as perhaps the most powerful blind user on the internet, to read text in PDF in an accessible format and make it searchable for all of us. Transforming PDFs in this format makes them accessible to everyone. The technologies that most widely benefit the disabled community are those which provide the widest range of transformations of this original text. And this is because there's no universal fix for accessibility. For instance, one user may be more comfortable reading a work on a normal screen, but at a much larger font size. A dyslexic user may benefit from changes in the foreground and background colors of text. A blind user may be able to read at the same speed as a sighted individual, as long as they are empowered to run text-to-speech utilities at a far faster rate than the average spoken speech, or indeed the default text-to-speech settings on devices like the Kindle. In short, copyright law needs to provide visually impaired users with access to works in formats that give them the ability to transform these works for their lawful uses, and an environment that facilitates disabled users creation and access to tools which they can adapt for their specific needs. We believe that there are two requirements for that, and I'll keep this short because it's in our comments, and also I'm short on time. Those two requirements are within the domain that we've been discussing of the exemptions. The formats that should be available are open formats. DRM, by its very design, locks down content to a set of pre-authorized and predicted uses, and set of transformations that may not best serve the needs of visually impaired users and other reading disabled users. And most importantly for us, it leaves no room for vital innovation by the visually impaired community. Secondly, the Copyright Office already recognized in its 1201 exemption rulemaking that where works are unavailable in open formats, persons should be able to circumvent, but not every person, blind or not, is a TV RAMAN. So everyone needs to benefit from the tools built by such individuals. So we feel that exemption should be widened to include the prohibitions in 1201A2 and B. I'll end there. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Attaway.
Thank you. In the notice initiating this proceeding, the Copyright Office listed a number of actions that might facilitate greater access to copyrighted works by the blind. Most of them, I think, are worth pursuing. Most of them relate to voluntary efforts resulting from good faith dialogue among the stakeholders to reach meaningful solutions that will, in fact, facilitate greater access to copyrighted works by the blind. The one possible action that I don't think will produce meaningful results is an international instrument, whether it be binding or non-binding. In most instances, copyright is not the primary impediment to facilitating access to the blind. In the case of movies, I don't know that it plays a role at all, but certainly it's a small role. So a copyright treaty is not going to solve the problems that you are trying to address. Secondly, the existing international treaties, copyright treaties, provide huge, broad flexibility for member states to provide limitations to national copyright laws for purposes such as providing access to the blind. Any international norm setting in this area is likely to be counterproductive. I very much agree with Ms. Russell that an international norm is likely not only to set minimum exceptions and limitations, but it's likely in effect to set maximum. And in an age where technology is moving as fast as it is today, that is certainly not a good idea. Further, a debate on an international treaty is likely to divert attention away from much more meaningful activities aimed to address this issue. Finally, I'd like to address the elephant in this room, and that is that for a number of people on this panel, the needs of the blind are not their primary focus. Their primary focus is to use this issue as a tool to advance a much broader agenda to eliminate DRM. And that is not a solution that in the long run is going to advance the interest of blind people. Whereas I think there are legitimate issues that blind people have with DRM, eliminating DRM is not the solution. It is improving digital rights management technologies that can provide greater access to the blind while allowing copyright owners to retain control over their works with respect to the vast majority of people who copyright owners depend upon to create the incentive to produce. Those who are opposed to DRM envision this fantasy world where all copyrighted works are made available in the clear for anyone to use, and miraculously, somehow, people out of the goodness of their heart are going to compensate copyright owners when they use these works for other than non-infringing purposes. That is a total fantasy world. It's not, it doesn't exist and will not exist. And to try to create this world will absolutely destroy any incentive to create copyrighted works and to distribute copyrighted works, not only to blind people, but to all people. The solution is not to attack DRM. The solution is to improve DRM so it accomplishes our goals of maintaining incentives to create and at the same time allowing blind people and others who legitimately want to use copyrighted works for non-infringing purposes. Thank you.
Thank you. Peter.
Protecting intellectual property in the digital era is both an expensive and complex undertaking. Pearson has devoted significant legal and technological resources in an attempt to manage infringement, especially in Asia. We've come to realize, though, that this will be an ongoing struggle for us, and the stakes are very high to Pearson, to other education publishers, as well as our intended consumers. That is why we believe that reliance on trusted intermediaries is a concern. We do not believe that publishers can always rely on third parties, especially internationally, that may not have the requisite technological skills, financial resources, and motivation necessary to control distribution and to prevent global piracy of digital files. Pearson works hard to create superior quality learning materials. The investment required is often in the tens of millions of dollars for any new K-12 program initiative. If we cannot reliably count on the legal protection of our intellectual property, that investment is put in jeopardy and could cause publishers like ourselves to rethink future investments, ultimately creating a situation where students could be deprived of our best possible solutions. As we've discussed earlier today, we comfortably work with many third parties who create solutions that, because of the uniqueness of their offerings and file formats, are not subject to widespread piracy. However, we remain wary of the expansion of the definition of eligible populations who may request more mainstream technologies that we are trying, that we are attempting to sell into the market in competition with free offerings. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we obviously have a lot of subtopics to cover, and I think what the panel would really appreciate is if any or all of you could give us a little more information about how accessible books travel across borders today. What are the business models? And any other information that you may have. Carrie.
I know we were asked early on by you, Maria, about interlibrary loan. Does interlibrary loan from, you know, academic universities or public libraries, schools, does that serve the need for the international people? No, it doesn't. Interlibrary loan offices report that they very, very, very rarely get a request from someone from another nation that's looking for an accessible copy. In addition to that, they would think that they wouldn't be able to do that in terms of sending an electronic accessible copy because that's usually what the people want. We have nothing in the law under interlibrary loan that gives us the idea that we can send digital copies, so librarians are hesitant to do that. And even if librarians could, they don't have the technology necessarily to create digital copies on the fly. So in the interlibrary loan, the existing interlibrary loan arrangements are not at all helpful. And it's especially a problem for students in higher education because, as we've heard, their needs are much more varied. You can't plan for them. There's not like a set core of materials that people are going to want. The agencies, as I understand, also feel very restricted in terms of meeting international requests because they're limited to citizens of the United States or foreign nationals. So you're not going to find any way to meet the needs that way at all. I want to thank Fritz for agreeing with me, but it gives me an opportunity to clarify my position a little bit. We do support an international treaty, but we want to keep in mind that WIPO is, it's an environment where we've fought for many years to keep, fair use in our country. We realize that we have the best copyright law. We just want to ensure that that stays the same and that we wouldn't get anything less from a treaty. We also support what Dr. Kirshner has been talking about and the use of trusted intermediaries. I think that publishers and vendors, they can trust the trusted intermediaries. If you couldn't, you would have sued them by now. They've all been very trustworthy and done a good job in following the copyright law and not been crazy pirates or anything like that. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I think although we're very interested in forthcoming solutions, right, for this particular question, what happens today? What are all the things, all the steps, maybe is the way I should put it, that need to happen for a book to be made accessible, a movie, Fritz, if you want, today, under what business models does it happen at all? Are there licensing schemes in place? What can we look to for some experience in this? Dr. Kirshner.
Scandinavia is the only example that I know of where they're moving titles across. Their languages are different, but they can understand each other. The libraries are trading amongst themselves. I'll give you 200 titles, you give me 200 titles. And their libraries are growing as a result of that. It's pretty informal. I believe they're doing this with the full knowledge of the publishers in the region. And that's the only thing I know of. I've had I know that the Sweden has come to Recording for the Blind and Dyslexic and asked to license to, we'll pay you some fees. And we've not been able to give those titles to the Swedes. As a result, they've had to spend $2 million a year duplicating the same books, the production that we've had to do. RNIB has come to RFB&D with a standing offer for higher education materials, and we've never been able to fulfill that request. They've said, we'll clear copyright with the publisher, and we've said we still don't have the right to hand a title over to somebody in another country. There's nothing that grants us that right, so it's almost zero in terms of looking to what has worked.
Thank you. Michelle.
Well, one area where we wonder whether there's some experience we can look to, but frankly we haven't heard of it yet, is with respect to public domain works. Is there any model of accessible versions of public domain works being made available across borders or internationally that we could look to, both as a way to kind of assess that there is demand and then also to just look at what the mechanisms are that are being used to transfer those works cross-border?
Can I go ahead?
Yeah, I have Dr. Kirshner, then followed by Mr. Love.
So we have about 500,000 titles from Google that are out of copyright. There are still some rights associated with it for the metadata that they've used for, but they're making them available and they're closing downloads to certain domains, IP domains, based on the copyright law in their country. They're just starting to do this. The Sony e-reader has a half million available that you could download. The Sony e-reader website is not accessible. It uses, I'm not sure what it uses, but it's totally not accessible. But I have had people download the titles for me and provided those titles, gave them to me. They're in the EPUB format. So that is happening right now. We've got the domain globallibrary.org. We've registered that. And we're going to explore taking books that are in the public domain and putting them into DAISY and making them available. But we haven't had the financing to do that as of yet. And we're trying to do that on a voluntary basis.
Let me follow up with you, since you mentioned the financing word. If you had all the financing in the world,
yes,
what would be your next? What would be your five-year plan?
Thanks for preparing. I think that standards and technology are fundamental. We got to nail those down. We got to get the publishers to participate in the standards development instead of having them sitting outside. O'Reilly has just put somebody on our working group for the revision of the standard, but I'd really want to encourage publishers to participate in that so that the standards are being built, so it's something that they want to use. I'd love to see the tools and the technology, the training materials to help modify, to teach publishers about what accessible publishing is all about, how it works, to put standard operating procedures in their publishing processes so it just becomes automatic. I think that rather than all the money in the world, finding a market model that works. And I think that having libraries serving people who are blind and print disabled purchase titles from the publishers would sustain the production of those materials. And I'm not saying that the libraries are the only ones buying them, but the libraries would be one of many. I think other libraries, individuals, schools would start buying accessible content. What we hear from the higher education in this country is, please just let me buy the accessible version, and they're never to be found. The schools put a heck of a lot of money into disabled student services to manufacture these titles that they can't get otherwise. And the titles they're manufacturing are not top quality. They're doing their bare minimum job of providing something to the student, but it's not equal, it's not a powerful reading experience, and it really should be, it should be equal. So I think I'd be looking at changing, trying to reinforce the entire infrastructure, helping publishers and the people who know about creating accessible books to work together, bring them together, and build an ecosystem that's mutually beneficial and can survive for centuries.
Thank you very much. That was as solid an impromptu answer on a five-year plan as we could have hoped for. And I have Jamie and Rashmi, but before I do that, Carrie, could you respond to the proposal that maybe libraries could help support an infrastructure and a market by becoming customers of accessible formats?
Yes. I'm going to, you know, it's one thing when you're making like a policy decision, we'd certainly want to participate in that because we want everybody to be able to read and make things easier for students and the public. But putting it into action, you know, it could become another one of those unfunded mandates where we might not be able to be successful at actually doing it. But if we did have the funding, I think it libraries are our core, and they are in every community, and they can serve many, many people that do not even know about the other specialized services that may be available.
Thank you. Jamie.
First, I hope at some point we're given an opportunity to respond to Fritz's comment.
You could do it now if you'd like.
Well, he referred to several people being here that didn't really care about access for disabilities having some hidden agenda about DRMs. And if he wants to, because I think it cast an aspersion on, certainly I felt like it was sort of, some people might have interpreted that he was directed that in our direction. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. And if he has the courtesy to be more specific in that with respect to our organization, I would encourage him to do so. But it certainly doesn't really describe our interest in the matter. And it doesn't even describe our interest in the issue of digital rights management, which I don't quite understand. The treaty that's been proposed is designed in such a way that the beneficiaries of the treaty that are using it would have to provide assurances that the works would only be used for the beneficiaries under the treaty. The way that's done in the United States under the exceptions, which is described extensively this morning, is through the use of DRM technology. I think DRM technology is used by all of the specialized entities in the United States, and I think that it's just something they have to do in order to fit within the national regime here. So, if you really, maybe you're advocating getting rid of the Chafee Amendment or something like that, but the Chafee Amendment allows people to create works, work through entities that make them available. Now, we certainly think that everyone that's focusing on this issue should not try and tie it into broader agendas about copyright exception limitations, intellectual property rights in other areas, patent agendas, or anything else. It should just really be on people that have reading disabilities, period. And it should either go forward or fail on that basis. I think the larger strategic issue is really the enemy of good policy in this area from our point of view. Now, in terms of the transporter movement of books, Bookshare has indicated that they have licenses, voluntary licenses, from publishers for about 4,000 works that they provide across borders outside the United States. It's unfortunate the Bookshare isn't here because I think they have experience in this area, and as Alan mentioned this morning, they have ambitions to do more. They would like to do more, and as they said in their written submissions, and it's our hope that they and other groups would be very involved. Now, in our comments, we reported on a case where a Columbia organization had contacted the CNIB in Canada to create a mechanism to share the digital library that both institutions have for places. But it was rejected by the Canadian library officials because they felt that their national exception in Canada didn't allow them to share it with Columbia. If you look at the Judith Sullivan report on the Latin American situation, she found that only 9 Spanish-speaking countries have specific laws benefiting visually impaired persons. And if you read Judith Rios's survey, which was submitted in the comments, you'll see one of the barriers that has been developing the transporter shipment has been either the lack completely of any limitation exceptions in many countries, which is really unfortunate. In some of the countries she reported, number of works in Braille in Nicaragua, 56. Number of works in Braille in, this is another country up here, it's, I'm having trouble with my DRM computer here, I guess, in Sierra Columbia. Very tiny number of works in most Latin American countries in some of these particular formats. It's really completely shocking. Bookshare is doing it. If a treaty comes into effect that liberalizes the import-export, it would be up to the United States in implementing its obligations under the treaty and other countries to do it in a way that was appropriate. You wouldn't just, I think, give a green light to everybody to do everything. You would implement it in such a way that you protected the rights of the publishers, as the case right now. As a lot of people have pointed out, there have been no abuses that anybody can point to in the Chafee Amendment. I mean, this is an area really of, if you want to find abuses, look at Hollywood. Hollywood, every time they come out with a new movie, it ends up on the internet before it's in the theaters from their own system. They're less trustworthy than the people doing works for the blind. I mean, I think there's actually more empirical evidence that they have a harder time managing the security of their copies than the people that are working on access to the blind. This is an area where good people that have been a proven track record are just trying to basically address an appalling inequity globally, and it won't happen unless the Obama administration supports it and leads.
I have Rashmi, and is anybody else in line? And then Alan, and then Danny. Okay, Rashmi. You were on the list a while back. Did you?
No.
Okay. Alan.
The main reason you're not hearing much in the way of experience with respect to foreign access to accessible works here in the United States is, of course, because the Chafee Amendment, like other aspects of copyright law, has no extraterritorial effect. It's one of the reasons why the good conduct that is reported on the part of companies like Bookshare continues to exist, because they're aware of that. And the only real rationale for an international treaty is essentially to get around the lack of extraterritorial effect. But if you consider for a moment that usually international treaties, particularly in this area, in the area of intellectual property, I mean, we're not talking about a treaty that's going to be ending a war or some other violent conflict. We're talking about a treaty that is designed to deal with questions of harmonization of conduct and rules for behavior. That usually comes into play when there already is an extensive consensus that leads to the idea that you can, in fact, achieve a harmonization, because most people are approaching the issue from the same general perspective about what are considered to be the appropriate rules and the appropriate conduct involved. I think, as I've suggested to you, in terms of the evolution of the Chafee Amendment over the last 13 years, there's at least a significant part of the community in the United States that believes that what we've seen in the evolution of technology, what we've seen in the evolution of the study of human behaviors going into the question of what constitutes learning disabilities, is an indication that the Chafee Amendment is no longer the Chafee Amendment as we understood it, or at least in terms of what people would like to export on an international level. It will not be what we've understood the Chafee Amendment to be as it was originally created and the purposes it was supposed to serve. So, you know, I don't think that there is a consensus to be able to sort of enshrine in an international instrument that indicates, in fact, that people have reached this core level of agreement. We see this problem, for example, with respect to the issue of textbooks. Textbooks in the United States are published regularly to a chorus of criticism that they cost too much. So then when textbook publishers also engage in the export of international editions of their textbooks, which are priced to the markets in which they expect to do business, we hear from the American consumer that somehow the American consumer, the student, is being gouged at home in order to serve these interests abroad, because they simply don't understand the idea of building international markets. If you're going to be able to deal with the issue of accessibility in the same way, you're also going to have to take into account different levels of infrastructure, different levels of capability for essentially absorbing this kind of technology and these kinds of models, including the models of trusted intermediaries abroad, under circumstances that raise a good many questions as to whether or not that's a reasonable assumption to make. I think one of the problems that we're having here in talking about internationalizing standards is that we haven't even reached an agreement on national standards in this area. And the irony, of course, would be that, generally speaking, in order to harmonize these standards on an international level, we would probably reduce rather than raise the standards that already apply in the United States in applying them internationally. That's something that I think generally would be viewed as unacceptable, certainly within the community that I represent. It's not the best way to try to address this problem abroad.
Okay. Thank you. I have Danny, George, and then Rashmi, but Alan, I have a follow-up for you.
Sure.
And, I think one way we have been thinking about this as a panel is that there are kind of two sets of materials that the publishers put out into the world. One of the things are the works that are already being distributed worldwide or regionally to the general public. And then the other set of materials are those that maybe aren't distributed very far to begin with. So looking at the first set, where you're already distributing in another country, could you speak to us a little bit about how the exceptions in other countries might work. For example, a trade book that's published in the U.S. that's then licensed to, say, a U.K. publisher, if there's a blind person in the U.K., how does that work? Do they get access or don't they? And if so, how?
Well, I mean, generally speaking, when you talk, that's another difference among the sectoral areas of publishing. Trade publishers, generally speaking, don't hold copyright in their work. What they acquire from the author who creates the work, who originally holds copyright and usually continues to hold it, is whatever exclusive license they need in order to be able to serve that part of the global market that they choose to serve. So in the United States, the author of a book typically will give to the publisher the right to publish the print version in the English language in North America. It's a geographic territorial limitation. Usually the rights, especially if they involve another language, will go to a publisher in that other country where that language is spoken. And so the American publisher doesn't really deal with that issue at all. To the extent that you're talking about the question of providing for accessibility, you gave the example of the UK, so we'd be talking about a common language. But I think the question would be, what's the nature of the license that was acquired by the UK publisher with respect to that particular work? I would suspect that it probably, well, indeed almost certainly, would be the same thing. Not copyright, but a very specific exclusive license in order to be able to publish that work within the United Kingdom, or perhaps within the Commonwealth nations.
So there's a sub-license to make the work available to the general public, but is there any way for RNIMB or Bookshare or someone else to make that work available in accessible formats?
To
a place where you've
someone already, outside the country
where you have already published it in general, yes.
Not that I'm aware of.
Pardon? Go. Okay, let's get back to our list. I'm sorry, Danny, and then George, and then Rashmi.
I'm going to do that classic moment in a long list like this of answer a question that was many, many minutes ago, which was to discuss the nature of the export of public domain materials. To go back to my original point about the possibility of communal and collective effort, one of the largest repositories of accessible public domain works is Project Gutenberg. I don't know how many works that they've worked together to produce now, but I do know that I have a DVD of them. And if anybody knows the storage nature of DVDs, that's an awful lot of ASCII. I also know that one of the issues that limits the export of that content, and there really aren't that many, because once it's seen to be in the public domain and once it's in a format like ASCII, it's simply a matter of putting it up on a website and it propagates. But I do know that one of the things that pushed the Eldred case was the subset of public domain materials that are in public domain in the United States but not necessarily in other jurisdictions. So I think this just goes to Kara's point, which is that I think that there can be dangers that one ends up creating maximums or minimums from maximums in these situations. But that's something that exists prior to the treaty. The problem with exporting public domain works is that there's no consistency about the nature of those works and their legality in other areas. And because the default when you're distributing content online is to distribute to the world, if you're in a situation where you have to make a decision to block, as we've heard Google has to block, certain books, that actually becomes a cost. So the inconsistency between laws ends up being an argument for not producing that material at all. I don't want to spend too much time on the DRM issue that Fritz brought up, largely because I think that rather it's very hard to discuss it without sounding like that is the particular obsession that we have, and I don't think that's true. I mean, the one thing that I would point out is, as Alan mentioned, is that these days it's a given commercial understanding that one doesn't need DRM to have a commercial market. The music industry has switched to a no DRM model over the last few months, And as Alan mentioned himself, audiobooks appear to be switching to that same context. George Kirscher mentioned that he sees markets moving towards a DRM-free content. So if we are discussing DRM, we should discuss it in the context of there are being commercial markets and non-commercial markets where DRM is not important. And I think one of the things we should say here is that if we are employing DRM, if we are requiring DRM as a nature of these treaties in this area, I think it behooves us to try and find evidence, one way or the other, that this is a risk. And there are ways of doing that. I know a number of people have suggested fingerprinting or tracking in some way. That we already have trusted intermediaries, which we don't have in other environments, who have an obligation to track and check these things. So this is a good environment to see whether this is really a case, a problem. But we know already that it is a problem in providing viewable formats. Finally, just as a general point, I do think we should be careful that we don't make the perfect the enemy of the good here. I think that there is clearly a demand for content that is commercially expensive to produce and would be desirable in this area. But what we're mainly dealing here with, I think, is a profound market failure in the general availability of these works. If it really costs us so much money to produce 50 works at a high standard, then perhaps we should consider a wider attempt, as Scott said, to just do it. Just produce content that we can convert into the simplest format and see if that can lead commercial production as the demand and the distribution systems begin to build up to cope with that very, very simple content.
Thank you. Okay, I know Michelle has a follow-up question for you, but let me just get my list straight. Hold on, Alan. I've got George, Rashmi, Alan. Anybody else want to get on the list here? Jamie? Okay, Michelle.
Thanks. I just wanted to follow up on the Project Gutenberg point and ask if you have any information at all about how much these accessible formats actually are used for the benefit of blind or other persons with disabilities. Is there any information out there that can kind of demonstrate to us interest in that or any way we could measure that?
You know, one of the ways that we could do this going forward, and I don't have net access, so I can't see. I know that one of the things that's a natural result of Project Gutenberg is that these formats are converted into standard ebook formats. And perhaps one of the ways we could do this, and perhaps this already happens, is to work with Project Gutenberg to put the DAISY formatted works available as well, and basically do a sample in that way, like point people to Project Gutenberg and see how that pattern emerges. I'm sure that's something they'd be very happy to coordinate with, although I don't speak for them, I should say.
George.
Trusted intermediaries are the caretakers of copyright. This is a little bit of an aside, but I'm the guy who told Michael Hart that he couldn't scan and convert everything, that it was illegal. And I had to explain him the copyright law. That was
thank you for doing
1991.
That.
And he was very upset with me. But Alan was talking about not having consensus. Okay, so where do we have consensus? Well, we've got RFB&D, National Library Service, and Bookshare, all using the same format for the distribution of content. We've got the DAISY XML and the navigation model being incorporated into the EPUB standard, and the DAISY consortium has been announced as call for comments becoming the maintenance body for the EPUB standard. We've got Google, who is distributing in the EPUB format, and we've got the publishers distributing EPUB to their distributors. So that's a lot of agreement. Then we've got all the libraries around the world who are providing legally material. They're all using the DAISY standard in the same format. We have started a global library project where we're investigating all the different issues associated with the legal sharing and distribution of content across national boundaries. We're looking at the federated search issues. We're looking at the copyright issues, the business models, how can we can involve publishers in this, and what are the technological aspects, safeguards for this. So there's huge consensus, and it may just be in the United States that there's this jostling for and competition. Everybody wants to own the whole market, and but there is huge consensus worldwide moving forward toward a copyright exception that would work.
Thank you. Actually, would you explain to us a little more about the Global Library Project?
It's jointly, we've got four people from IFLA, Section for the Blind, in the new name, and four from the DAISY board. And that's the oversight group that are running this project. Then it's been divided up into four different working groups coming up, and we're just in the first year of this, so we're just setting up our strategies and how we're going to work. But one of the big ones is what is the business models that are going to be effective and working, and so that's just getting going. We've been inviting publishers to join the DAISY Consortium. It's $1,000 a year to be part of what we're doing and contribute to the standards development, but we've not seen a big move toward that. It's been more in the library and the education sector where we've seen people joining, but it's an open door policy.
And the goal of the is it to serve the general public? Global Library Project
Global Library is looking at people with disabilities throughout the world. So we're looking at how that would work to serve people with disabilities. And I think one of the issues is going to be the identification of content in particular formats that work for people with disabilities, because we know that some formats that are going to be made commercially available will work for some disability groups, but not for all. A deafblind person is not going to be able to use an audiobook. But a deafblind person would be able to use an ebook or full text and full audio multimedia book. So these are some of the issues that would be addressed. Also, if the book does have text, then it could be used with refreshable Braille. So there's a lot of different issues in serving people with disabilities that are not normally considered in the design of mainstream systems.
Just one follow-up on that, and I'm wondering whether the Global Library Project, or if not that project, perhaps some other effort that you're aware of, has an initiative just, and it sounded like there might be something like this, just to compile information, a database, an extensive list of some type of all of the accessible works that are out there available at this time in different formats that might be useful to people with various different types of needs and capabilities. Is there any type of international effort to compile that information?
Analysis of the different formats that are in use today and how useful they are.
Well, not just the formats, but then what works are available. So, somebody could look up and say, well, actually, in, Canada, this work is available. And then one could look into, is there the ability to license or other ways to make it available? But just, in other words, a centralized database or system for finding out what accessible works in various formats are available.
That sounds like a federated search to me. That would be the kind of thing that would be identified. What the formats are in? What are the jurisdictions it could be made available in? If there are interlibrary loan fees or exchange fees or something, what are they? How can it be done? It would be the way to find the information about what's available.
And is that available now?
No. Google has joined the DAISY Consortium, and they know a little bit about searching. And we hope that they could help us. But all of this is work that's being done with literally no funding. And, you know, we get together when we can at other conferences. So you tack on a day here, a day there to get things moving along. And it's all part of, you know, the night job that all of that people have. So it's voluntary work groups associated with activities of the DAISY Consortium.
Okay, we have a list of people, but Michael, you had a follow-up.
Sure. Just to put a finer point on Michelle's fine question, reading through the comments, I was looking, obviously, for what might be called actionable policy items. And one of the commentators mentioned a kind of very diffuse concept of a national registry of accessible works. And I think Michelle might have had that in mind. But as I kind of browsed deeper and deeper into the comments, I thought that we really had kind of a head start on this. Even today, we learned that RFB&D Library, I think there's 50,000 digitally recorded items. The American Printing House for the Blind, I think we earlier heard 196,000 books. Bookshare, I missed that. Later on, we heard about the Access Text Network that is about to be launched, could have 300,000 titles. So it sounds like at least one of the steps in this process, and this is kind of a many-element process to enhance accessibility, is to begin to build the kind of database here in the United States that would allow us at least to locate accessible materials. So if you could pull that out a little bit more for us, that would be great.
The Louis database, I think, was the reference when you said 196,000 titles.
Yes.
That couldn't
not right.
That doesn't exist, but the database.
We need a clarification on that.
So RFB&D uploads our list to the Louis database.
Okay.
And
we have 170 agencies that have uploaded that information.
There you go. So it's in the United States, the central
right.
place to go to find out who's got what.
But am I correct in understanding that there are some limitations to that there could be accessible works that would not be loaded into that database because it's actually pretty much limited to works that are available under the Chafee Amendment, or is that an incorrect understanding?
I can't be sure about that. I think that under the Chafee Amendment, yes, but a lot of times it's state-driven. Like I mentioned earlier, the state of Texas, they have titles that they make available for the state of Texas by the state of Texas, and they stay in the state of Texas. But the ones that make up the 196,000 titles from the 170 agencies are all either audio, large print, or in Braille.
And commercial titles are not
trade books, generally.
Yeah, but not commercial titles that are accessible are not included.
No.
But there aren't many, so there wouldn't.
Mostly.
But it would be good to add that. And I'm probably confused about who uploads whose information to this database. So.
Well, if there's any way to, in follow-on comments, to begin to clarify this, we'd be most appreciative.
For a second?
Sure.
Can I bring my colleague Tom up for a second?
Actually, is it on this point?
Yes.
If right. you could...
Not to send all the information.
Okay. And then we have Rashmi, Alan, and Jamie to follow.
The Louis database, to my knowledge, includes things that are not there just because of the Chafee Amendment. So some publishers use that as their repository to distribute works to people with reading disabilities. So, and we often give permission to release those materials as well.
Thank you.
Rashmi.
I wanted to address the point of harmonization and how the lack of consensus will mean that an international treaty cannot be negotiated. Well, a lot of international copyright treaties did not represent consensus among countries. The TRIPS did not. There was a TRIPS Council that monitored whether countries have actually amended their laws to come into compliance with TRIPS. And then there was flexibilities that were given to developing countries. They were given time to come into compliance with TRIPS. The point I'm trying to make is that in this area, the need for harmonization is to ensure that copies can be exported and imported. The reason they might not be happening is because, as Alan mentioned, the territorial nature of copyright law, but not because there is no desire or there is no need to export accessible copies. It is not against the purpose of copyright law to make these copies accessible, and having a treaty that will guide countries and develop a consensus about how copies can move across borders will help in the movement across borders. That's the point.
I have a follow-up for you. For sure. Countries that don't have an exception currently, don't have our experience or our history in working through this issue and having an exception bubble up from the ground up the way they certainly do in this country. Mm-hmm. Are there other ways to provide guidance?
Other than a treaty?
Yes.
I guess that desire to have an exception should come from within, and then they would follow models that are developed in other countries, depending on how much resources they have to be able to develop their own models. That should not prevent countries who are at a stage where they really want to exchange copies to be able to do that. I mean, you saw a number of case studies in the Sullivan report where different countries and specialized entities in different countries have talked about how they cannot get accessible copies from other countries, but they really do want to get copies. And these are agencies who are the trusted intermediaries that everyone is talking about. A treaty facilitating such movement would be important for them.
Okay, but I just want to make sure I understand, because I think I just heard two separate thoughts. One is that to the extent another country has an exception that's similar or somewhat similar to the Chafee Amendment, there's an immediate need and there should be some facilitation of moving accessible books across borders. Right. But for those countries that are not remotely at that stage yet, what we're really trying to get at here, I think, as the government panel, is what role is there for us, for WIPO, internationally, private sector, public-private partnerships, to provide that kind of guidance that you identified?
I am not sure what can be done. I think that a treaty will help them fashion an amendment if they want to have an amendment in their domestic law. Beyond that, I'm not sure how I can answer your question.
Let's go to Alan and then Jamie and then to Michael.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on two things, but before I just forget it, to mention that in connection with your discussion about a database, it is hoped that fairly soon, and Gary can correct me if I'm wrong about this, but it's hoped that fairly soon the NIMAC and LUI databases will be searched in coordination together, which will greatly expand of material that ultimately will be contained as a result of a search. It's now already capable. I just wanted to go back to two things. One was Danny's comment about DRM. I think he gave a more optimistic translation of my comments than I offered myself. What I was trying to say was that in markets like the audiobook, where people have found evidence, market-based evidence, that they don't seem to face a problem in the absence of DRM, that's all well and good. There are obviously other markets where that just hasn't proven to be the case. And there are other business models, for example, looking at a different side of the publishing community that deals with journals, where the ability to go online was predicated on the use of DRM, and the whole system continues to operate based upon the ability to use DRM. If you didn't use DRM, you couldn't have online subscriptions to journals. But then my comment about George's view when we were talking about consensus, I mean, George is a giant in the world of standards, and it doesn't surprise me that he tends to see things through that prism of standards. But standards isn't the only issue that we're dealing with when we talk about the need for consensus and its current absence. The best example I can give you of that is that, again, the IDEA amendments in 2004 were enacted after 4 years of planning by a very broad coalition that included, in addition to AAP, the NFB, AFB, and all of the other various well-known advocacy groups for the disabilities community. And one of the two pillars of that concept that eventually became the IDEA amendments was the idea of eliminating the patchwork quilt of file format standards by the introduction of a uniform national standard, the NIMAS. The fact of the matter is that that was going to require preemption of contradictory state or local requirements of formats. But given the views of the state of Texas, there was no preemption. And the fact is that today, since the enactment of the IDEA amendments of 2004, which is only 5 years later, my school division reports to me that we have seen over 150 separate legislative or contract or regulatory proposals on the state level, continuing to propose different formats to be required of publishers for books in those jurisdictions. So what's happening here is when you ask the question, Maria, about what's the role for government, for the U.S. government in this area, it's fine for the U.S. government to be looking outward internationally and seeing whether or not it's possible to, you know, extrapolate some of our experience here and some of the value of our experience here and see what it can do there. But look back, okay? We haven't changed the fact that the states and local governments are continuing to legislate, continuing to issue their own contradictory requirements in this area. And if you think an international treaty is going to mean anything to the states or local governments in the United States, it simply won't.
Jamie.
Thank you. On this issue of DRM, in our point of view, there's DRM and there's DRM, and I think it's unfortunate that it just kind of gets all compressed into a single term. I mean, there's a lot of things that people accept very much, like watching Netflix and paying for it and having to have a password and abiding by the rules, or on an online thing like Westlaw or something like that, paying money to have it and having a password type thing. People may get also kind of upset, though, if they can't, you know, do a cut and paste of the text or they can't do other things. And a lot of these are fights over what rights that consumers traditionally had in paper products. They were able to make private copies. They were able to sort of use things in their research and clip and annotate things. And they're fighting. And there's some – so there's a range of battles about how DRM, you know, where it's appropriate or not appropriate and what kinds of DRM really, really annoy people as opposed to things that they think are less – are sort of don't cross the line and highly context specific. So I just wanted to get that out on the table because I think the authors have a point. I think that livelihoods really are at stake. I think the rampant privacy in the digital world is a legitimate problem, and I don't think consumers have done enough to speak up on behalf of creative communities and basically defend the legitimate concerns they have. I agree with what Peter Weiner said in Slashdot last week about it. He's an author and a friend of mine, and I think he was absolutely right that things are really, you know, there's a problem there. And I don't really want to minimize it at all because I think it is legitimate. And I don't think this is really, should be seen as an attack on that. And I think that the extent that these trust things are important, I think everyone is ready to go on that front. Now, in terms of the treaty thing, I mean, you know, can we do a treaty for people who are disabled or blind despite massive evidence of an absolute book famine? I mean, just an absolutely appalling human rights violation in developing countries and even across the border. Even if you look at the situation in Canada or something like that, let alone go to Kenya or to Bolivia or some places like that. Can we do it? Well, we seem to be able to do treaties. Public knowledge mentioned the TRIPS agreement. I mean, there was the 96 treaties, which were done in about 2 years, the WCT, the WPT, when they sort of basically, the decision was really ready to go ahead. They've been talking about this problem in import-export for about 20 years at WIPO, and they've gotten nowhere so far. The broadcast treaty, MPAA was all over the broadcast treaty, even though the United States had never signed the Rome Convention. They wanted us to have the, you know, sign a treaty to bring a set of rights that they couldn't get through the U.S. Congress, but they went basically to WIPO to try and promote a set of economic rights that didn't exist in this country. ACTA is on a fast track. It's a secret proceeding. There's basically no real transparency of the actual negotiating text. So when it comes to the sort of can-do attitude about things, here you've got a thing where consumers are involved and people are disabled. And I'd like to see some of that can-do attitude that you can solve problems, that every time right owners basically speak up and call politicians, they seem to get a lot of attention. And we'd like to see the same amount of priority and attention in this particular area. Now, the reality is, if you permit this norm setting at WIPO, and you permit import and export, the bottom line is Americans will get access to foreign works, and foreigners will get access to U.S. work. If you don't do the treaty, Americans will not get access to foreign works, and foreigners will not get access to U.S. work. That's what this is about. It's about whether or not these accessible copies, and it's not just about a digital text, and the kind of things that the DAISY format does requires a lot of marking up of the text, identifying chapters and headings and things that allow navigation in the way that a person that can see can use a document. And people have mentioned how expensive it is to make a lot of these Braille copies. This is really about expanding access or not expanding access, and if the Obama administration doesn't lead, it's not going to happen. Now, I know that Brazil has now announced that they're going to table the World Blind Union text at the end of this month in the SSCR, and they've appealed to a number of countries, and they've written a lot of countries to support them in doing so, and they will have co-sponsors in that endeavor that will take place very soon. So the WBU text will become the Brazil text, or the Brasilia text plus whoever joins them. It should be the Brazil-United States text. That's what it should be. It should not be a fight between developing countries and Americans on this thing. The United States should align itself with those countries, and it should go in together into that proceeding and get rid of this north-south debate on this issue and really make this a common cause to basically address a really important human rights problem.
Thank you, Jamie. Fritz, you're next, but we are actually going to call a break. It's 4 o'clock. We've been sitting for 90 minutes, so if everybody could be back at 4:15, and Fritz, you'll be first when we return. Okay, thank you so much. In the home stretch, I know it's been a very long day, and we just wanted to reiterate how much we appreciate everything that we have been told and everything that you've taken time to explain to us today. And with that, Fritz, you're up.
Just a very quick point on harmonization. It should be recognized that there is a degree of harmonization in the Berne Convention. And that is, member states can do basically whatever they want in terms of providing exceptions and limitations so long as they meet the three-part test. There's tremendous flexibility already in the Berne Convention. And then the second point I want to make is that if international harmonization to facilitate access to copyrighted works by the blind is desirable, I think that the discussion I've heard today, particularly from those who are actually engaged in trying to achieve this objective, suggests that WIPO is not the right forum, because even to the extent that copyright is a issue, it is certainly only one among many that face the blind in achieving this goal. There are technological issues, there are economic issues, there are a number of issues far outside the scope of WIPO that have to be addressed in order to make a solution meaningful. So if it is decided that international harmonization is desirable, I would suggest that a different forum be found where all of the issues involved in this problem can be addressed, not just copyright, which is at best only one of many, and in many instances, certainly with respect to audiovisual works, a tiny issue.
Michael, do you want to follow up on that?
Sure. Well, thank you, Fritz. And I at least wanted to pick up on part of your comment, because even before the break, I felt the kind of inherent need to clarify a bit this international framework for exceptions and limitations. And Fritz gave me the segue. And of course, under the Berne Convention, as we all know, there is a longstanding framework under which countries may tailor their exceptions and limitations to advance national, cultural, and economic and information policy making. Indeed, the very exceptions that we operate under the U.S. Copyright Code and the Fair Use Exception, and even our Section 121, are reflections of the very latitude that is given countries to craft these exceptions to meet their own policies. So I did want to make that clear, and thank you, Fritz, for introducing that point. But I want to revert back to a point that Maria made earlier, and it might have kind of glossed a little bit into the background and maybe didn't elicit a full response, and I think it's an important one. And that is, and this is notwithstanding Fritz's point, what in our discussions, for example, in the Standing Committee, might we do to promote the kinds of exceptions and limitations, maybe even short of a treaty, that would begin to facilitate these cross-border movements? I'm thinking in particular that, as you all know, between peaks of norm setting, from time to time, WIPO has been very helpful in periods of guided development, where technical assistance and legislative assistance and discussion do provide that kind of give and take with countries. And I guess another element of the question is, we'd be very curious to know about specific instances of impediments in the national policymaking process where countries are not taking advantage of the full range of exceptions and limitations that the Berne Convention framework already gives them. So that's my question to you all. Anybody want a bite? What could be done?
If I could just interject for a minute. We have two people who have to catch flights. So, Scott, I had promised a couple of minutes to give some remarks as he runs to catch his flight. And, Peter, I didn't know if you had to leave right now or not. You're good? Okay. Scott, the floor is yours for a few minutes.
Well, Michael, I don't have an answer to your last question, so I'll duck out on that. But a few things in sort of conclusion, and I appreciate the, first of all, I appreciate the opportunity to be here on behalf of the National Federation of the Blind and your willingness to take these comments now. I do need to get back to Denver for a meeting tomorrow morning. With respect to a lot of the arguments that Alan has been making today and others of a similar mind, respectfully, a lot of them seem to be kind of slippery slope arguments, talking about possible nightmare situations that have not really occurred, even though under the current system, copyright infringement and NIMAC and all the problems that have sort of arisen. Certainly there are some. But let us keep in mind that that has not really been in effect except for the last couple of years in terms of real implementation. Are there bugs to be worked out? Yes. But does that mean the system is not worth pursuing? pursuing or doing or fixing and using as a model going on into the future? I don't think so. And finally, the idea about, you know, whether there are other alternative ways other than a treaty to address some of these things, I would think so. I mean, I think there could be all kinds of bilateral, multilateral, trilateral agreements, sharing of experiences to start dealing with the issues. But I really do urge our country to be a leader in this and to set the framework for a treaty and make it happen, because it has to happen. We just got to go do it. So that's
okay. Thank you very much. Safe flight back.
Thank you.
And back to Michael's eloquent question. Keith, you were on the list. Did you want to take that question?
I don't think I have an answer for that very difficult question myself. I want to address some things that I think, honestly, Fritz beat me to the punch a little bit about. I mean, is, you know, under the Berne Convention and the TRIPS Agreement, there is this three-part test, and that's under that test. That's where we have the Chafee Amendment, 121, Section 121. And there's really nothing, as far as I can see, preventing any other country, any other region from adopting that same type of approach. I don't know if the folks around this table or other folks have been, you know, sort of pushing that approach internationally, but I don't, and to sort of clarify SI's or my comments earlier, I mean, with regard to international treaty or harmonization, I'm not necessarily opposed to it. I just don't see what it gets us. I think there's so many other issues on the table, and as I said before, as Fritz said earlier, you know, copyright is just one of those issues, and there are many, many other issues, and there's many other things that folks around this table and other folks here who couldn't be here could be doing. And let me just give one example of that, at least for the industry I represent, the software and digital content industry, and maybe this somewhat gets to Michael's question a little bit. You know, many of those files are actually written in a few mostly open source software programming languages like Java, Perl, and Ruby. But those open source programs generally do not include accessibility in their design suite. And it's possible, certainly those, you know, folks in the room, and especially those supporting a treaty, one of the things we could be doing is, you know, could be helping design features in open source code that programmers, designers can incorporate into their software programs. Since they use these open source programming languages, why not create accessibility features that can be, or functionality that can make their products accessible? And that's a sort of one example that has honestly nothing to do with the treaty that certainly could be done. I think there are many things like that that if we all sat around the table, came up with a list of things that all the interested, you know, the stakeholders here could be doing a little bit more.
Thank you, Keith. I have a question about right of first publication and best practices. So earlier, Rashmi had said that at least to the extent where there's another country that has an exception in place, like the United States, with respect to sharing accessible books across borders, those exceptions should be able to speak to each other, if I could paraphrase. And I guess the question is, if a publisher is already making a work available, they've already selected to publish a work in a foreign country other than the United States, who's the right party to make the work available? And I'll ask both the publishers and anybody else who wants to jump in to respond to this from both sides of the coin. Starting with Alan. Well, Jamie, you're on the list. Anybody else want to jump in? If you could raise your hand. George?
Of course, that's going to depend, in some cases at least, on specific circumstances of the legal framework within a given country. I mean, the best example I can give you is China. At the moment, U.S. publishers are not fully free to publish works in China unless they essentially have a Chinese partner for purposes of publication. That's part of the price you pay for market access into that particular market. There are a number of other countries.
Alan, just for ease of the example, though, could we stick to, say, the U.K. or Canada? Let's keep it close.
I guess I would say if it were, you know, you would either think that if you're talking about trade publishing, where, as I said, what is given is an exclusive license. So you're not talking about the copyright owner being the U.S. publisher. In that instance, I don't know that the U.S. publisher would necessarily have the right to authorize the accessible version of the work to be published in the U.K. Part of that would depend upon whether the rights that the U.S. publisher obtained from the author included digital rights. It's the same issue we've been sort of talking around
sure. In
this whole context. It is the reason, as I said, that with the passage of the IDEA amendments, we needed to amend the Chafee Amendment to get specific protection for publishers who would have otherwise been held as infringing for allowing the digitization of material that they didn't control the right to.
Right. And we understand the complexity of contracts, but I think for the trade book, I think what we're trying to get to is what kinds of best practices do you need? What kinds of incentives do you need if you're already making a work available to the general public to also make it available in accessible format? And Rashmi, please feel free to jump in as well.
Well, I'm not professing to be an expert on how copyright law exceptions or incentives for publishers should be tailored to make works available. We're simply saying that if they're not making works available, then exceptions within the law should allow works to be available to the blind, and where works cannot move across borders and different markets are not served by publishers with accessible copies, those entities that are responsible for creating accessible copies should be able to send it across borders to where they're needed.
So if I understood that correctly, if the publisher is not making it accessible, then a nonprofit or a trusted intermediary should be.
Or whoever else that, national law or consensus indicates is the best person or best entity to make the work available should be able to make it available.
Maria?
I mean, yes.
I understand your question. The only way in which you have a cross-border issue is if you have the U.S. rights holder authorizing this in the UK. If the US rights holder has authorized publication of the work in the UK, then it would seem that if the UK rights holder deals with the issue of accessibility, you're not dealing with a cross-border issue.
Indirectly you are. So it's the fact pattern that we were interested in learning more about, but
okay.
I think if we have Jamie and then we have George and then we have Keith.
I'm happy to go after George if you want to.
Sure. George?
Well, okay, so if the book is published in the United States and produced in an accessible form, and it's also wanted in the UK, so the point is we're trying to avoid both organizations in both countries manufacture the same thing. And what we need is the mechanism to get the book over to RNIB, and they distribute under their copyright legally. That's the vehicle we need.
And I think we understand that. You've made that point before. I think one of the questions we had was, does it matter to you that the publisher has not already published that and chosen to publish that work to the general public in that country? Sure.
We discussed this extensively. When we had this experts meeting last summer, this was a really huge issue that was debated because the Europeans in the Green Paper were very much pushing a model of limitations and exceptions that they come into play when there's a market failure, when there's a lack of a voluntary license or something. And it was basically that model. And some of the European groups were very keen to sort of go down that road because they're very keen to get backed by the European Commission. In the United States, with the Chafee Amendment, you had a lot of groups that had a bad experience with arguing about whether or not something was available in a reasonably equivalent form, and going through the negotiations and the hassle, so there was a conflict, and it was sort of a huge conflict actually within the room. And Judith Sullivan was part of this conversation, the WIPO consultant, and the way it was resolved in the conversation was that the nonprofit exception, such as done under the Chafee Amendment, would be embraced was the American system, which was no permission, a very broad exception. It's just a very a lot of freedom of the specialized entities basically to use and create works on the one hand. And then if there was a but the extent that you move beyond that specialized entity, then you'd have that test. Is the work reasonably available in identical or largely equivalent format for access? That's the first part of it. The second part of it has to do with, is it published or not published in a country, or what does that really mean? And that was an issue that we kind of went back and forth on. And it was probably the most frustrating thing for people in the room to kind of deal with that issue. And so the resolution was, and I think it was the right resolution, was to say the condition of the export and the import is that the copy has to be it said that the person had lawful access to that work or a copy of the work. So basically what people decided was that it would have to be lawful in the country of import for it to be authorized under their own laws. And so if they didn't consider the work a lawful import because it had never legally been published, then you couldn't do it. But if for whatever reason...
Right. So if a publisher does not publish a work in India, nobody is suggesting that an Indian nonprofit should be able to make that work into an accessible format and distribute it.
No, the lawful access applied to everybody. Nonprofit, in terms of the import-export, it would apply to in terms of the minimums. The lawful access was something that everyone felt captured everything you'd want it to capture. I mean, that is to say, the point is not to use the exceptions to rewrite other fundamental rights, but more...
I think you're talking about all the different ways that a work can make it into a foreign country, and I think what we're asking is something more along the lines of right of first publication, and whether that would be somehow overridden by a nonprofit saying, well, the publisher didn't choose to make it accessible in this country or even publish in this country, so we're going to take on that for the greater good.
Well, if India decided to give rights to people who are blind that they didn't give to people that were sighted, I mean, I personally wouldn't lobby against that, but I'd be kind of surprised if that's the way it took place. But I mean, I think that the bigger interest people had was that it would be left up to national discretion as to what constituted legal work in that country, and that it was not like a super right that was being granted. It was the idea that you were facilitating trade in an area where everything else was otherwise on the up and up from a legal point of view. Now, if you have a better phrase than has lawful access to that work, everyone has a very open mind. That's what came.
I think we're mindful of right of first publication, and maybe Alan, could you speak to that?
I think, and we were I won't say unfortunately, we were a part of this. But when Congress amended the Copyright Act in 1993 to provide that the fact that a work is unpublished is only a consideration in the fair use calculus, I think it set up basically the criteria for essentially the vast dilution of any meaning in the right of first publication. And it certainly wouldn't surprise me if in the United States at some point we ran across the idea of people saying that fair use should allow them to publish a work not published in the United States for the commercial market, provided that they're only publishing it for purposes of people who have an accessibility issue.
This isn't a disability issue. This is just a question you have about copyright in general.
And we definitely don't have enough time to talk about fair use. We have 20 minutes. So. Keith, you were next.
Yeah, let me answer your initial question and then your follow-up question, if I understand it correctly at least. Answer your initial question in two parts. One, depends on whether we're talking about the first release of something or retrofitting. When we're talking about the first release of a particular software product or digital content product, in many cases, our member companies will do their best to make sure that includes the accessibility functionality. If we're talking about
Keith, just to interject, so that's a sort of best practice for your industry.
Yes. In terms of retrofitting software or digital content, it's a very different story. I mean, as I think a lot of people talked about in this panel and earlier, oftentimes the cost associated with retrofitting, whether we're talking about software or digital content, is many times more than the original cost and therefore is really not a viable business model. So if you're talking about, well, who's going to bear that cost, well, then, I mean, it doesn't make any sense for the publisher to do that. I mean, they'd be out of business pretty darn quickly if they did. So really, you're talking about whether we're talking about retrofitting or whether we're talking about incorporating good accessibility into the first release of a product. So that's one area. Then you asked the question about what incentives might publishers need. And, you know, I wish I had come up with this idea myself, but I read it in one of the comments, and I don't recall whose comment it was, but somebody in their comments talked about the fact that the Chafee Amendment was sort of more of a stick, and that maybe we need a carrot type of approach to give publishers some sort of tax break in order to incentivize them to...
Stimulus package?
Yes, exactly. So... And I thought that was at least worth certainly trying out there, and I think that certainly would give the necessary encouragement and incentive for publishers in certain areas to incorporate the accessibility functionality into their products. And then I think the last issue you brought up was, if I understand this correctly, is what happens if the original is not made available in that particular country, and then you really open up, I have to say, a can of worms, not only forgetting about right of first publication, which you've raised, but also a whole bunch of other issues that have to do with different, especially when you're talking about software, which is liability issues and things of that nature, which a lot of times are very good reasons that a company or a publisher is not entering a particular market. I mean, heck, they already have the product, and so there's a very good reason for that, and all of a sudden... if just making that product available in a particular country might all of a sudden subject them to some liability. I know with regard to software companies where they rely on licenses quite a bit, all of a sudden maybe the laws in that particular country are a little bit different and they have an equivalent of a first sale doctrine, and maybe all of a sudden you've inadvertently kicked in the first sale doctrine even though they've never actually sold in that particular country. So that's also another consideration.
Yes, Danny.
Just very quickly, just to again shift this to the other context, I think there's interesting comparison with these kind of conundrums and the possibility of being able to take a legal copy and transform it into a viewable or perceptible format. And in those sort of cases, you sort of neatly sidestep this issue, because what you're dealing with there is a lawful copy, as Jamie says, in that particular context. And you are granted a permission to render that into an accessible format. Now, that's not... That limits, given that there's a limit to how much a commercial ebook can be turned into a perceptible format. But we're much closer to that situation now, where there's a growing and rising ebook backdrop than we were when we're talking about trying to convert books into an accessible format. And that sort of gets around this problem by just moving this idea of what's a legal copy, who has liability, into the area of being able to make a personal copy that's perceptible.
Just getting back to the objective of this whole day has in part been for us to go to WIPO and report, and then there may well be discussion about what WIPO can do in this area, and I understand there are views for and against working on a treaty, but putting that aside, what else would you like us, if we had the opportunity to ask WIPO to get involved on this issue, what else would you like us to ask WIPO to do? Are there things WIPO can do in terms of training, in terms of helping with standardization of formats, developing technical norms, maybe helping to train and develop trusted intermediaries in countries that don't have them? Those are just some suggestions. Are there ideas that you have for us and for WIPO about what WIPO could do across the spectrum of what we've talked about today?
If you could raise your hands, okay. I have Dr. Kircher, I have Carrie, Jamie, okay, George.
So, lost my mic. To your right.
There we go. Okay, so one of the things that rang as resonated with me was Peter's statement about he doesn't know these libraries. And I understand that. You don't want to give the keys to the kingdom to people you don't know. So the relationships haven't been established. I know these people, and I trust their organizations, but you don't. So perhaps one of the things that could be done is to establish a mechanism for existing trusted intermediaries who want to work together to model it, to do it on a small scale. I don't know how many libraries, but if there's a way under a provisional treaty or, I don't know, a way to authorize the movement of content across national boundaries, establish the policies, procedures, best practices, protection, invite publishers to view the process and become comfortable with the trusted intermediaries that everybody knows RFP&D and Bookshare and Library of Congress here, and that's great. But once you get outside the United States, you don't know those people. So maybe we could help there. Of course, I was helping Alicia Wise draft a proposal where we talked about the software development training materials for publishers to help them in their publishing process. The amount of money that was being asked of WIPO to do this was pretty small, but those kinds of things would help a lot. Pearson's a big company; they've got a lot of resources. They're getting it together. The smaller publishers, they don't understand. If we could help them with their publishing processes. Provide training, tech support, websites, forums to ask questions, those kinds of things. That would help, and develop the best practices with the people who are willing to develop it and then share that information in the industry. I think all of those things are great ideas.
Thank you for that very constructive suggestion, the sort of pilot project. Carrie.
I agree completely with what George just said. I think that we can help other countries by being models for them. The three-step test, I think for many people, is a tinier allowance than Michael believes that it is. So I think we need to help people at other countries realize that the three-step test can help them establish, if this is possible, can help them establish exceptions in their country like we have. I think encouraging people to do that, I think that because of how countries seem to be much more hesitant, I think we know this is true, to initiate any exceptions. So somehow they think the three-step test is very, very small.
Sorry, Jamie.
Well, there was a long time when the World Blind Union was trying to get WIPO to do some model legislation on exceptions for the blind. I mean, but one of the issues you come up with on something like that is that itself almost, can become a negotiation, and so it's not always possible to avoid having a negotiation. If anything that's really going to be important is going to be controversial. I just say as a practical matter. So one of the initial model laws they had was something that was did not include, for example, the Chafee Amendment. And I didn't really hear the United States complaining about the model law because it didn't have the liberal Chafee Amendment provision. I was a little disappointed not to see American negotiators sticking up for American traditions in the model law in WIPO. That would have been good. And maybe you could insist that if there is model legislation, it is as liberal as the Chafee Amendment is as relates to nonprofit institutions. That would be very patriotic. That would be good. Another thing that would be, in terms of the pilot projects, I think that most people see the pilot projects as really constructive and useful things. And I know that the World Blind Union and DAISY and other people have worked very hard on this trust building and with the publishers to sort of have some trust building exercises. I see these things as operating in parallel with discussions about other norm setting thing, because at the end of the day, they won't work unless you have figured out the details of these trust-making things. And I don't see why you'd want to wait for either thing. Both of them are going to take a while. And if you think the books before were dead slogan in the UK Right to Read campaign is important, that you might get going now on some of these things. There is a big issue of, can you export under limitations and exceptions? And a pilot project to violate a law or a treaty is good. I'm all for it. I mean, really, don't get me wrong. I mean, some people may not be quite as enthusiastic about it at that end of things. And so, if you want to have, a temporary suspension of treaty obligations or national laws, that's interesting too. But you might just, if people don't know if you can do a copyright exception across the board, instead of WIPO, you might go right to the WTO, like they did that in the Doha Declaration. They had this problem of exporting drugs for medicine across borders, and they had a separate declaration in November 14th, 2001, in Doha, where they clarified that they would find a solution, and 2 years later they did on that topic. And maybe some people here would rather see you at the World Trade Organization instead of WIPO and having you say something about what the TRIPS does or does not say about the three-step test as it relates to this problem. I think that might be actually something to think about if you're looking around for things to do other than to go to WIPO. That seems to me to be at the root of the problem about whether you can import and export across borders. The other thing is that WIPO, the proposal WBU, and that will be tabled by Brazil, calls for a database of available works by WIPO. And people, actually, Michael talked about this earlier. It's Article 10 in the WBU proposal. And actually, I think that would be a very useful thing for WIPO to do for a couple of reasons. It would make it more transparent about what the landscape of accessibility was. And it would promote the interest of publishers that are trying to make accessible works available in both the nonprofit and the for-profit field. So if Pearson wants to advertise it has accessible works, if Bookshare wants to advertise it, if anybody has an accessible work, I think that would be good. And that's something that WIPO could do without a treaty. They could set up such a voluntary database.
Thank you. And I feel compelled to say, if it wasn't clear, that the United States government was not suggesting that we voluntarily violate a treaty, but rather that we somehow have a facilitating role in a pilot project that might be a voluntary business model between publishers, libraries, technologists, et cetera.
There's voluntary licensing that's taking place right now, and it doesn't require WIPO. I mean, Bookshare is doing it already, and there's conversations year in, year out, month in, and month in. It shouldn't be a bad faith smokescreen and kind of a strategy to deter people from WIPO doing its job, which is dealing with intellectual property norms, by turning and a work agenda at WIPO on copyright limitations and exceptions on a negotiation session with the publishers, which arguably should be taking place outside of that UN agency, unless you want the UN to start supervising all the negotiations of all your licensing contracts. That would be interesting. I think we should consider that. But if it's about setting intellectual property norms and not about managing Random House, maybe you've sort of given them the wrong job. The other thing you might ask is, you might ask the President of the United States, Obama, who disabled text-to-speech on his books about 2 weeks ago through Random House, and Vice President Biden, who did the same thing, that sets a very bad example. And when he lines up with the Pope and Mother Teresa, and they all disable their books so people who are blind can't get access to them on Kindle, I think that really shows the gap between what's happening on the ground and what should happen on the ground.
Okay, we're approaching 5:00, so at this time I'd like to ask my colleagues on the panel if they have any final questions. Neil, Michael, Michelle, Steve. And now to the participants, does anybody have any final concluding remarks? I've got Mr. Mudd, Mr. Adler, Mr. Love. Okay. The floor is yours, Carrie. The floor is yours, Gary.
Thank you. I
just wanted to make a correction to something I said earlier. Alan asked if the LUI database and the NIMAC repository were working together, were searchable together. I said, yes, it is this summer that they will be searchable. And that's why I wanted to correct that. Thank you.
Alan?
Well, I just wanted to finish by, we've been talking about this treaty that apparently is going to be tabled at the meeting, but we haven't really talked much about it. You know, this treaty contains a provision on circumvention of technological measures. It contains a provision on orphaned works for commercial uses. I mean, this is pretty far-reaching stuff that, as far as I can tell, goes way beyond the issue of whether or not we can provide accessible versions of American works outside American borders. It just seems to me that our government, meaning no disrespect to the panel, of course, because you weren't that particular segment of the government, but our government in the form of the U.S. Congress has pretty much left the publishing industry and the other stakeholders here to flounder around with this issue, which is why, as I say, in the past 13 years, we've devoted as much time working on state and local legislation as we have on federal legislation, and now we're being asked to consider an international treaty. I don't think that the issue of ensuring cross-border access to accessible versions of works is, at this stage of the process, a sufficient justification for moving away from all of the unresolved work that's still left in trying to develop consensus, harmonization, if you will, beyond just standards on these issues and the way they're addressed here in the United States. It's pretty clear to me that publishers, I see this within my own organization's membership, make their own decisions about what to do with this based on what they think is appropriate and good for them in the marketplace. Many of them have decided, as I said, to work with Bookshare. Others are working through other means. We know that there is some voluntary licensing cross-border that these publishers have agreed to. I really think we should be seeing more of that continue to percolate and finding ways in which we can continue to develop those efforts before we reach out to something that is so far beyond anything that we've accomplished here in the United States and anything that's likely to meet the requisites for participation by other countries who've accomplished even less on this issue than we have here.
Thank you. Jamie.
Well, I look forward to Alan's endorsement that the U.S. pull out of the active negotiations, because all these foreign distractions are obviously overtaxing our ability to solve domestic issues. But I mean, the reality is that Alan's organization and Fritz's organization are hyperactive through the USTR, through bilateral trade pressures, through FTA negotiations, regional negotiations, unilateral actions, through the World Customs Union, through the act in a million different ways to have international norm-setting activity in areas that they think are in the interest of the publishers to enforce and expand their rights. Now, I think that they're businesses. They have a reason to do that. People that have reading disabilities that can't even read a book, that in other countries where they have countries that have like 100 books in Braille available to them or something like that, they also have rights and they have interest, and they're going to expect that there be some attention to their needs as well. In fact, I think they've been underserved for the past two decades. And so this sort of idea that the domestic agenda is so important, you can't do the international agenda. Well, just fire all your international lobbyists, because they are really, really making a lot of work for us too. We let's just call truce in all the international negotiations for a while. But that's not going to happen. I wish it would happen, but it's not going to happen. So I think that realistically, international policy is not just about the giant, big, powerful corporations that control this town. It's for ordinary people. It's for people that are powerless and weak, because in politics, sometimes they're given a voice by some political figures that think they count.
And Carrie, the last word.
I just wanted to, you know, given the maze of Chafee and everything else that is out there, the new technologies. I just want to commend the existing federal agencies that are working with the blind and visually impaired, the Recording for the Blind and Dyslexic at the National Library, and the American Printing House. They do an excellent job given what they have, and they're very dedicated workers, and their librarian agents throughout the states have been really amazing people to talk to.
Thank you for that. Okay, well, that concludes our day. Again, on behalf of the Copyright Office and USPTO, we are very grateful for your time and the comprehensive remarks that were made here today. The transcript, both written and audio, we're hoping will be on our website, copyright.gov, by
later this week.
And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Michael Shapiro, who's, of course, the head of the U.S. delegation, for some concluding remarks.
Thanks, Maria. At the end of a long and, I think, enormously productive and stimulating day here in beautiful Washington, D.C., I've been really asked to say a few words of where we've been and where we are and where we will be going, or might be going, at the international level. At the 17th session of the Standing Committee on Copyright and Related Rights at WIPO, we had a very stimulating discussion also of exceptions and limitations broadly, including exceptions and limitations for the blind and visually impaired. And at that meeting, the U.S. delegation promised that we would come back home and begin a series of consultations with all of the stakeholders whose equities and interests touched on this important issue. And when I said that, I was very hopeful that the discussions would be productive and stimulating. I think as a first round, this session far exceeded my expectations. I've enjoyed every minute of it. I've learned a great deal. So what's going to happen next? Next week, the U.S. delegation will leave Washington and go to Geneva for the 18th session of the Standing Committee on Copyright and Related Rights. And at that session, we will provide a briefing on what we've learned from the public comments, the reply comments, and today's discussions. We will do so with the hope that we will stimulate a discussion in that forum and learn from other delegations as well, because we firmly believe that in this discussion, it's so important to begin them at home, where the voices of all stakeholders can be heard. And we want to learn from our other colleagues what they're learning as well. Finally, we expect to provide this additional information, and we assume that this will be the beginning of a conversation that will advance this important topic. That's where we are.
Okay. Thank you, everybody. And for those of you that have traveled, safe travels.